2 Samuel chapter 6 for this evening. Plodding along chapter by chapter, verse by verse. Wednesday night's Old Testament. And we did not get through chapter 6 last week. We got down to really verse 13. We read verse 14, but we can't take credit for it because we didn't study it. So we'll pick up right there, verse 14 this evening. It's quite a story we're right in the middle of. I guess if there's any story in David's life to slow down on, this is a good one. One of the good ones. Because we've seen a historic moment for the nation of Israel just turn to absolute disaster. It was certainly intended to be one of the most glorious days that the nation of Israel would experience up until this point of time, not counting the the days of Moses and the establishment of the tabernacle, the receiving of the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, all that stuff. This was after hundreds and hundreds of years of really being off track. This was supposed to be the day that they got the nation back on track, back to the Lord, back to His Word. Back to worship in the tabernacle with the Ark of the Covenant in there. That's something that they had been missing for a long time. Saul didn't care to do anything with it. Just left it in someone's house and probably didn't give it another thought. He certainly didn't move a muscle to get it to the tabernacle. But one of the first things that David wants to do as king now over the 12 unified tribes of the nation of Israel is get the Ark, the centerpiece of the tabernacle, back in the tabernacle, the heart of the worship, or at least the symbol of the heart of the worship, back in the worship center for the nation. And they did what probably most of us would do. In their own human ingenuity, in their own human thinking, perhaps in a way that had been patterned for them by, of all people, the Philistines, they decided to throw the ark on a cart, as if they were, lugging around bales of hay. But it was a new cart, so it was clean ceremonially in that sense, and they thought this would be a good idea. It was not a good idea. They were not doing it according to the word of the Lord. You know from our study last week, the Lord was very precise about how the Ark of the Covenant should be moved. He gave them instructions on how to do this. The Levites, they were going to haul this stuff, right? But the Levites, they weren't priests. So they couldn't touch this stuff. The brazen altar. The bronze laver. The candlestick. The table of showbread. The golden altar, the altar of incense. The Ark of the Covenant. The Levites were not allowed to touch those things, so the Lord made sure to give the instructions for the priest to wrap it up all nice, to bundle it all up so that there was no potential for a Levite to accidentally or intentionally reach out his hand and touch one of the furnishings of the tabernacle and bring guaranteed, promised death upon themselves. But this is a nation that has drifted away from the Lord for a long time. They were still conducting tabernacle services to some extent. But when it came to what the Word of God had to say about this issue, they just weren't well versed enough to know it. And it was a good lesson to us, yet another lesson, once again, on the fact that God's people oftentimes destroy our own selves and mess up our own lives because of a lack of knowledge. It's all in here. God gave us the manual for life, physical, earthly life, and eternal life. It's the manual right here. It's all in here. But do we know it? When we know it and we act on it, we can pretty much count on blessed lives, with only those rare exceptions where the Lord might want to make a Job out of you, right? But when we neglect to really search and study and find out what's in here, then we can bring a lot of undue burden and hurt and pain upon ourselves, messes upon our lives, simply because we did not know what the word of the Lord said. So the story goes that Uzzah, a Levite, Just doing what anyone would do in that situation, being concerned as the cart starts to teeter and the ark starts to wobble. And so he throws out his hand to stabilize the ark. Of course, Lord, you're not going to want to let the ark hit the ground. But see, that's, I think, where the Lord would step in and say, hey, this is my ark. I don't need your help. I don't need you to save me. I can handle my own things. What you should be doing is following my word. You should be doing the things I told you. You shouldn't be touching something that has a death sentence attached to it. And the Lord did make an example out of Uzzah. And Uzzah died. And David was angry at first. And anger turned to fear, which is always healthy, so long as you don't look at the Lord as a monster and don't fear him like that. But that fear drove David to the word to find out how to move the ark. And now they have done that. The ark is now being relocated to Jerusalem, to the tabernacle in Jerusalem. And we'll pick up reading there. Verse 14, it says, and David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. Okay, so I gave you guys homework last week, right? Chris already pointed this out to me. She must have done her homework. She doesn't want me to forget this. She wanted me to come back to this, all right? So if you've done your homework, it would be really fun to see what your conclusions are. What was the question I asked you? Should David be wearing a linen ephod? Was that the question? Something to that effect. Now, what do you think? Thumbs up if you think it was okay for David to be wearing a linen ephod. All right? Thumbs down if you think David shouldn't have been wearing it. Do this, thumb sideways, if you don't care and you just want me to move on, okay? It's as close to unanimous as we get in this church, so. Well, I'm going to share with you my viewpoint on this, and I do want to just let you know up front that you do not have to see this the same way that I do. Scholars are divided over whether this was an okay thing and just exactly what we are reading here in this very quick statement of David was wearing a linen ephod. It obviously must be important, right? Or else it would not be attached to this verse. Like, David was dancing with all his might before the Lord. What an awesome day. By the way, David was wearing a linen ephod. Kind of gets the flag up, right? If nothing else, it gets the flag up that says that needs to be studied more. Okay, so first of all, a statement that kind of settles the issue from the beginning for me, and that is the fact that linen ephods were to be worn by those in ministry, by priests. The Levites wore linen tunics, okay? So not even the Levites would wear a linen ephod. But for sure, only the priests were supposed to wear linen ephods, as far as I understand it, in the law of Moses. Now, they were worn over the undergarment that I just mentioned to you, the long linen tunic. We would call those the robes. So those were the garments that were underneath, and they were long. They covered up everything. They were sleeved. They went all the way down to the ankles. The ephod, however, was nothing more really than a decorative apron. So it is unusual apparel, to say the least, to read about David wearing here clothing that belongs to priests. And then to top it off, in order to do this, he had to take off his royal garments and not wear his royal garments. And instead of being dressed like a king on this very special day, he's dressed like a priest. And he's not a priest. And so that says to me that on this day, David had something very intentional on his heart as a motivation, and that is worship. And I'm going to commend David for that. I think it's like, you know, to take off the royal garments and to wear a garment of worship, that's saying that on this day, me being king, that doesn't matter. Me being a servant and a worshiper, that's what matters. So it's communicating a good statement. I think the passage itself and the verses that we're going to read here a little further on when we hear from Michal, I think those passages are going to give away the fact that David was indecently exposed. Michal is going to say that outright. She's going to say that David uncovered himself. Those are her words. That he uncovered himself before the female servants. David, the female servants, they saw way more of you today than they ever should have seen of you. So, Michal certainly thinks that David is indecently exposed. And so that's why I'm going to stick with that interpretation based on biblical understanding here. I don't think Michal would have just pulled this out of the air. And David was not wearing his kingly garments. And he was showing a little too much flesh for the time period. And yet on that positive note, he is all in on worshiping. That's what the garment is communicating. He's all in on worshiping on this day. So we won't take that away from him. And I personally am not going to take anything away from what Michal has to say about David on this day either. I think her concerns are well founded. So we read in verse 15. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. Okay, so I shared those verses with you last week from 1 Chronicles that either David or the priest, someone went to studying the word of God. Someone found it in the law of Moses, the way that God had prescribed for the ark of the covenant to be moved, and they finally figured out the right way to do that, and then they have now successfully moved it the way that the Lord wanted them to. So last week as we were studying this, they were trying to do the right thing, but they were doing it in the wrong way. This week as we study it, they're trying to do the right thing, and now they're doing it in the right way. This is in accordance with the Word of God, the Old Testament Scriptures. So success is guaranteed, right? They're finally doing it the way the Lord wants them to. Verse 16. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Jerusalem, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing and exposing before the Lord. Okay, I added that one word. And she despised him in her heart. That's strong. I mean, she went from loving David in 1 Samuel, remember that? This was like love at first sight. She loved David in 1 Samuel. Now in 2 Samuel chapter 6, she despises him in her heart. She hasn't even given him a chance to explain himself. She's just decided to despise him in her heart. And we'll talk about that more in just a moment. But verse 17, and they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent, which would be the tabernacle, that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. Okay, you think this would have been like a bigger story that would have given, you know, more space to it in the scriptures. For whatever purpose, the Lord didn't decide to do that. But we just had a very quick insert to notify us of a really big thing. And that is that David has reconstructed the tabernacle there in the city of Jerusalem, the holy city. This is a new tabernacle for sure. It's not the tabernacle that was erected previously under the reign of Saul, and it is not the same tabernacle that was standing in the days of Samuel. That got destroyed by an enemy. We studied that in the book of Judges. In the book of 1 Samuel. So this is a completely new construction. David has had the tabernacle rebuilt. They have a worship center now where it should be. And now they have finally brought the ark to the tabernacle in the worship center. So I like this. You know, when David was reigning over just the one tribe of Judah, he was reigning from headquarters in Hebron. That's where he set up headquarters. But now that he's reigning over the 12 tribes, he picks a more central location, a little further north, Jerusalem, the holy city. And he wants the tabernacle, not just like military headquarters or the royal palace to be headquartered out of Jerusalem. He wants the tabernacle to be there too. And now it is, and we read in verse 18, "And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings," by the way, this isn't really David that's doing the work of offering up these sacrifices. You understand that, right? I know he might be dressed like a priest, but he's not a priest. He can't do this. He cannot offer up sacrifices for the Lord. When it talks about David offering up sacrifices to the Lord or offerings to the Lord, that just simply means that David is commissioning these offerings and the priests are carrying them out. Okay, by the way, that's why I didn't buy into it as we read about Samuel making offerings to the Lord. That's why I didn't buy into it that Samuel was overstepping biblical boundaries as only a Levite and doing the work of a priest and making offerings and sacrifices before the Lord. I never once bought into it, and I stand by that. Just because we read that someone's making an offering, that does not mean they're doing the work of slaying the animal, of bleeding it, of offering it up on the altar, of divvying out the portions. No, that's the work of a priest. And so David is letting that happen. And it says after that, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. And we would call that a benediction. A benediction. I like to end every Sunday morning service with a benediction. You've noticed that. That's a stated blessing over the congregation. But I do want to point out here that there's a particular order. You know, when we're looking at ministry and how ministry functions and what ministry priorities are, there is a proper order to that. It's just a two-step process. And that would be number one, verse 7, David blessed the Lord. That was first. Number two, second, verse 8, David then blessed the people. So you see the order? It's important that you see the order and that you know the order. The Lord is blessed first, and then the people are blessed second. Our aim, our goal in ministry should be, first and foremost, if not only, to bless the Lord, to please Him. That should be our main focus as ministers of the gospel. Secondary to that, as a byproduct to pleasing and blessing the Lord with ministry, well, then the congregation should be blessed by that as well, right? That's how it's supposed to work. If we get it any other way, then it's altogether wrong. We can't think that the first priority of ministry is to make the congregation happy, to do ministry in such a way that the whole congregation will be wowed. That's not the point of it. No, that's a byproduct of ministering to the Lord. I don't know if you remember this, but way back in our studies, if you were with us, Leviticus, Exodus, Numbers. I said those out of order, but you get it. Our studies, we read it over and over like it was getting pounded into our heads, the ministry responsibilities of the priest. What was it? Just over and over, we got this. The priests were to minister before the Lord. They were to minister, literally, to the Lord. That was their main function. That was when they were doing it right and their priorities were straight, their main concern in what they were doing in ministry was to bless and please the Lord. They weren't thinking, oh, I hope the people, I hope the congregation likes how I made the sacrifice today. I put a little extra flair into it just to kind of get people excited. That wasn't his concern. His concern was, I want to be by the book. I want to do ministry the way the Lord wants it done because I want Him to be pleased and blessed by it. So the goal is not to minister in a way that pleases the people. The goal is to minister in a way that pleases the Lord. And if you get that part right, then you don't have to worry about whether the people like it or not. That's up to them. And the truth is, you're never going to please everyone. There's going to be plenty of people that, I don't like how they do church. I don't like the songs they sung. I don't like the order of the service. I don't like the emphasis in the teaching. Whatever, you know. I mean, I hope it's not that way for you. But you just can't be our focus. Because if you're our focus, that means, you know, there's how many other people sitting by you now that I've got to focus on, okay? Well, if I've got him happy, okay, great. Now, can I get her happy? And then him and her. And it's an impossible feat and an unnecessary one for a minister to pull off. Nope. We want to please the Lord first and then trust that because God set it up this way, the byproduct of blessing and pleasing Him will be that the congregation is also blessed and pleased, edified. If you please the Lord, you're doing the right thing for everyone involved, whether the people like it or not, whether the people know it or not. Verse 19. I hope you guys like that. That's a joke. Oh, I got a sideways thumb back there. just keep going, Arlen. Verse 19, so David blessed the people after he blessed the Lord and distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread. Sounds better than it is, but it's just a loaf of bread. A portion of meat. Yes, thank you, please. And a cake of raisins. That's the good stuff right there. That's the dessert for the meal. A cake of raisins, a little Debbie. And so a full meal to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house. So remember, David, when he went on this mission to get the ark, he took 30,000 people with him, 30,000 soldiers to serve as sort of a guard detail for him in the endeavor of fetching the ark and bringing it to the tabernacle in Jerusalem. But they've returned with that now. So this is a celebratory meal. Bread, meat, and dessert for the entire nation. Look at verse 19 again. It says, they distributed this among all the people, not just the 30,000, all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both men and women. So what I'm telling you is that this was one ginormous church dinner. I mean, massive. Madam Secretary, how'd you like to be in charge of that one? How'd you like to wash dishes after that one? That's a massive church dinner. Sideways thumb or downward? I missed it. Okay, sideways. He's indifferent. Everyone's indifferent tonight. You are a tough group. Now, the only difference here is that this is a take-home church dinner. So actually, there would not be any dishes involved. They give them all their meals, but we just read it. They all now depart, each one to his house. And we read in verse 20, and David returned to bless his household. So he has the dinners for his family as well. He's returning home in order to give his family members their church dinner. But I don't think we should restrict David's intentions to just the meal when it says that David returned to bless his household. I think this is more about delivering meals to his family. I think this is about the exuberance of the day. You know, the bigger picture would be that David is excited about what the Lord has done for Israel on this day. It is a huge day in the history of the nation. They have successfully retrieved the ark and brought it to the tabernacle without any further deaths. They got it right the second time. So David is on a spiritual high, and he wants to share that with his family, but his one wife, which is a weird thing to have to say, his one wife, Michal, she is not going to be in the same frame of mind as David comes home to bless his household. He's flying high in the spirit, but she is upset, and she is about to wreck all of that for him. He's in the spirit, she's in the flesh. We've all had to deal with this, I think, or something similar to this. Maybe it was in your younger days when you came back from a youth camp, and man, you were just flying high. All the good stuff, you heard the gospel, you're just flying high. You're in high spirit, and you get home and things are different at home. Or, you know, you, in more recent days, go off to a men's retreat or a women's retreat, ladies' retreat, or a leadership conference, and you come back just bubbling over. You're so excited about what you've heard and what the Lord has done in you. And you're just waiting to share that experience. You're waiting to bless your family. You're waiting to bless your spouse with all of the stuff that the Lord has done for you, and you get home, you bust through the door, you're so excited, and the first thing you see is the countenance of your family member, And you get the rude awakening that, oh, that's right, they weren't there with me. They weren't getting fed like I was. They weren't getting blessed like I was. They weren't getting edified like I was. I got away from the daily grind for this camp or retreat or conference. I got away from the daily grind, but this family member of mine, they were stuck in it, and it looks like it ground them to powder. You know, you're ready to tell them about the incredible things that the Lord did for you, and they're ready to tell you about everything that's gone wrong since you left. Can anyone relate to that? The husband says to the wife, well, I'm glad you're doing well, but I nearly starved to death because we didn't have food. I thought you'd stock me better before you left. You're the grocery shopper, not me. The wife says to the husband, well, I'm glad you had a good time, but I've been fighting the broken washer and the clogged drain that you said you fixed. And it's not fixed. You know how these kind of things go. It's the crash from the spiritual high back to daily reality. I heard the word. Yep. Daily reality. Or, you know, maybe it can even be two people sitting beside each other in church, and on the way home, one is stirred up in Christ and the other one is stirred up with something else. And you can't even make it home before the argument breaks out. In any of those cases, your spiritual high can fly away just as quickly as it came to you. And the enemy loves to use that tactic. He loves to do what he can to bring us crashing down from our spiritual highs. He loves any tactic that pulls that off. It's something that Jesus warned us about in the parable of the sower. Matthew chapter 13, Mark chapter 4, Luke chapter 8, parallel passages of the same parable, that he'll try to stop the seed from growing in you in the first place. And there's a lot of ways that he can do that, but Jesus gave us the example of the birds. You know, the enemy will send the birds, the demons, to snatch away what has been sown in your heart. That's a quote from Matthew. To snatch away what has been sown in your heart. The devil loves to do that. Or he can toss a bunch of rocks into the garden and make the soil so rocky that what you heard, that what you experienced, that what was sown in the heart doesn't really have enough space to take root. Or he can sow some thorns in to the soil of your heart and squeeze out the blessings that you've received, the good word of the Lord that you've received, you know, the broken washers and clogged drains of life, that kind of stuff. And much of that time, you know, the bird brains, the blockheads, the jagger bushes that Satan uses in life, who are they? They're the people that are closest to you in life. They're sweetheart and honey. They're father and mother and son and daughter, family members, very close brothers and sisters that the Lord, he doesn't lose them to damnation, but for just a moment, you know how this is, the devil can trick them and get them to act or speak in such a way that would attempt to tear you down from the spiritual high that you're on. You know, it's your loved ones having one of those Simon Peter moments where Jesus has to say, get behind me, Satan. You have no idea what spirit you're of right now. Get behind me, Satan. And again, I want to point out Jesus, who was not calling Peter Satan. He was recognizing the work of Satan, the voice of Satan in his servant Peter. And you'll have to do that too with your loved ones when this happens. When you sense that the enemy is using them to try to tear you down, to try to level you off, to try to bring you down from your spiritual high. Don't call him Satan. Don't do that. That makes things worse. Then the police show up, and it's not fun. No one wants that. But recognize the enemy in them, and silently, because you're not Jesus, silently rebuke the enemy in that situation. Well, everything I just described to you, in its own way, is happening to David right here. And I do not believe that David handled this as well as you and I will need to handle this if we're not going to lose our spiritual highs. So let's read it. Let's watch how David handled it. Let's learn from it. It says, reading on in verse 20, "But Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, 'How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself.'" Okay, so Michal has two issues with what David did on this day. During the Ark's welcome home parade, she has two issues with it. Here's her two issues. Number one, she thinks that David was honoring himself. Why might she think that? The only thing I can think of is the fact that he's wearing a linen ephod. The fact that he's wearing the garment of a priest. Again, I'm firm in this. I don't think he should be wearing this. So it seems to me that it's like Michal saying, you know, David, you're a poet, you're a prophet, you're a king. Is that not enough for you? You got to pose as a priest today too? That's like way out of line. What you were doing is trying to draw attention to yourself, trying to put yourself in a position that you really don't belong in. You're the king. Just be the king. And then secondly, she accuses David of uncovering himself, indecently exposing himself in front of other females. So the accusation from Michal is the reason why I think we have to acknowledge that David was scantily clad here in some way. So, does Michal have valid points? What do you think? I certainly think she does. She's often classified as the bad guy here, but I don't really necessarily see that. I think she could have handled this better. But I think her arguments make a lot of sense. First of all, it was, at the very least, arguably insensitive for David to wear a garment that only a priest should be wearing. Secondly, I don't care how good your worship is. I don't care how exuberant it is. I don't care if your heart is in the right place. Your body needs to be covered. It needs to be decent. Everything needs to be done decently and in order, right? If you're worshiping the Lord and at the same time causing other congregants to lust, I think you're the one that messed up. I think you're the one that needs corrected. I think you're the one that needs to change behavior. So I don't blame Michal at all for being jealous here. Actually, it's kind of refreshing to know that this is not a modern problem. The fear of someone else finding your spouse attractive and maybe trying to steal them away from you, it's not a modern problem. It's not exclusive to us. This is a problem that is as old as dirt. All right, it's jealousy, basic jealousy. You guys know how I feel about basic jealousy. Jealousy over a spouse that you love is a good thing. And that's only good or bad depending on what you do with it from that point. But jealousy reveals love. If you're jealous, that means I love this person and I do not want to lose them. Now, if you go too far with it and you say, I love this person and I will kill anyone that tries to take this person from me, now you've crossed the line. A really big one. Again, the police are going to need to be called for that too. So, yes, there's a line there, but jealousy in and of itself is a sign, a very good sign that love is present. And then just to side with Michal for a moment and strengthen her argument, if David is not wearing enough clothing and he's cutting up a rug out there, worshiping the Lord, well, what happens when you're wearing a robe that's not fully covering everything and you're just flying around dancing with all your might, what's that doing? It's exposing even more of you. So the situation is exacerbated by David's frantic worship, by David's dance moves. So yeah, I think the other ladies were seeing parts of David that only his wife should be seeing. And then that opens up a whole nother can of worms, like, well, which wife would it be appropriate for? Michal initially, but then they divorced. He married her again, so he really, by the law of Moses, shouldn't be with her. Would it be Abigail, the second wife? Was he really fully divorced from Michal when he married her? I don't really know. How about the other ones? He's got how many other wives now? I don't know. Thinking about that makes my brain hurt, so I'll just have to leave it at that. Probably one of his wives this would have been appropriate for, but no one else. Simply put, David was dancing with enthusiasm. He just didn't have enough coverage. He needed to be covered better. And then I do believe Michal is also upset with David because he not only was wearing the linen ephod, but he wasn't wearing his royal apparel for this. And that was, in her estimation, I believe, degrading for David and not very kingly of David. You know, to be not in his kingly clothes on this day, to be out there dancing and flipping out, just so excited, acting like a kid. She sees this as not very sophisticated and becoming of a king. I think I can kind of hear her saying, my father would never have acted like this. My dad would have never done that. My dad knew how to be a proper king. What are you doing? You're out there making a fool of yourself. You're embarrassing yourself and you're embarrassing me and all the rest of your wives. Terrible thing. If she didn't imply that already, I believe David certainly does with this next statement. Okay, if you think I'm reading into that, just know this. That's how David took it too. Look at what David says in verse 21. And David said to Michal, it was before the Lord. I was doing this for the Lord. I don't care what people think. It was before the Lord who chose me above your father. Ouch. You see what's happening here? Don't you dare compare me to your father. Don't you dare. Don't forget, if your father is the standard for how a king should be, don't forget, he's the guy God fired, and I'm the guy God hired to replace him. I'm the better man, okay? I'm the guy that the Lord picked over your dad. So don't compare me to your dad. You know how married couples hate that. Don't you dare call me my mother. Don't you dare compare me to your father. You know how that goes, right? Couples fight over that. I'm sure couples have probably even divorced over that kind of stuff. And a lot sillier stuff. But this, what we're seeing from David, yes, okay. You don't have to agree with me. I think you should, though. What we're seeing from David is a very immature and unhealthy way to handle a marital disagreement. So it seems like maybe polygamy wasn't working out too well for them. What do you think? Of course, right? And then it says, and above all his house, you know, God picked me over your father, and above all his house, his kids too, to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord. David is not going to budge on this. He is going to double down, and he's actually going to take this a step further. I'm not going to stop worshiping the Lord like this. In fact, verse 22, I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. You don't want me to dance half naked before the Lord? You know what? I'm going to do it And I'm going to take it even further next time, right? He says, but by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. Ooh, husbands, never do that. Never say that to your wife. Well, the other ladies liked it. What's your problem? The other women, they liked what I was doing. You're the one with the issue. I'm fine. No, don't do that. Okay? It amazes me. It amazes me how many people read this verse and just automatically assume that David is justified in everything that he's saying. It amazes me. Well, it's David, so he's got to be doing the right thing, right? His arguments are correct, right? He's David. Well, I've shared with you, I actually side with Michal in the majority of this. If I lean in one direction, I have to say I agree more with Michal than I do David here, seriously. And this is where the hardcore Pentecostals get it wrong and get themselves into trouble. They'll use verses like this, specifically this verse, to support disorderly activities in public church services. You know, if you try to say, well, look, that's a little out of line, it's a little too radical, they'll bring you to a verse like this and say, I'll be more contemptible than that in the next church service. I know what I learned from David. The lesson there is you can worship the Lord in public however you want, and don't you let anyone else drag you down with their whole public worship propriety rules. That's what they take away from this passage. That should not be the lesson, the spiritual lesson. That should not be the takeaway. All right, I think the Apostle Paul had plenty to say about orderly conduct in public church services. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. You familiar with it? I think Paul and the Bible has a lot to say about worshiping God on God's terms. You can't pluck a verse like this out and learn from David that you can worship the Lord however you want and you don't have to worry about what other people think at all. We need to look at this entire passage with an open mind. Don't assume that David is right just because he's David. This wouldn't be the first time in the Bible, it won't be the last time, where a hero of the faith made a less than perfect decision or did a less than perfect thing. In fact, it won't be the worst that we get from this guy right here. You know what I'm talking about, right? The story of Bathsheba. No, I think this is a mistake. I think he's handling this very poorly. I believe the Bible is trying to show us not how wrong Michal was, but I think the Bible is trying to show us a domestic dispute between David and Michal. And then I think the Bible wants us to figure out what's right about it, what's wrong. How is it handled that's right? How is it handled that's wrong? And then not make those same mistakes in our own marriages. That's why I think this story is here. And in my opinion, they're both in the wrong. David more so than Michal. My opinion. And the easiest way to figure that out is to go to a verse like Ephesians chapter 5 verse 33. Where through the Apostle Paul, the Holy Spirit gives commands for husbands and wives. They get one task each in that verse. If you look at that verse, it says, however, let each one of you love his wife as himself. That's the husband's instructions. And let the wife see that she respects her husband. Do you see that they both dropped the ball with this verse right here? They both just completely messed up the contents of this verse. What did Michal do wrong? She didn't respect her husband. She disrespected him. Seems like she compared him to daddy. And she just lambasted him as soon as he got home. Just pounded on him. And that was disrespectful. She, in an indirect way, referred to him as just one of the vulgar fellows. Wouldn't take that too well if I was a husband. She disrespected him. And what about David? What did David do wrong? David didn't love his wife the way that Christ loved the church, and that would be sacrificially. That's also in Ephesians chapter 5. Michael should not have jumped David about this the way that she did. And David should have said, honey, I had no idea that would hurt you. I wasn't even thinking. I was just out there. My mind was focused on the Lord. I am so sorry. I won't do that again. That's what he should have said. How many think I'm right on that? Okay, your marriages are healthy. I can tell you that right already. Guaranteed. Instead, what did David say? That's what he should have said, but what did David actually say? David basically said, don't you dare compare me to your father. I'm a better man than your father. And if you think what I did today was bad, just wait. The next one's going to be worse. That's what he said. Very immature. Very unhealthy. It's almost like the Lord knew when he inspired Paul to write Ephesians 5:33 that like the two big issues in a marriage is that a husband love his wife sacrificially and that a wife respect her husband. Because that's like the, you know, in a marriage, the thing that a woman needs most is the love of her husband. And the thing that a man needs most is the respect of his wife. And there you go. They failed on both accounts here. Now, beside all that, I am a firm believer that Christian spouses should never talk to each other this way. They shouldn't do this. They should not get into verbal knockdown dragouts. There's certainly, I don't believe, find it in the scriptures to prove me wrong if you can, that husbands and wives should raise their voices to one another. I don't believe that should ever happen. They should never argue. Now, I didn't say disagree. It's okay to disagree, but here's what you should do as a Christian couple. You should dispute discuss, don't listen to the first thing I said. You should discuss your disagreements, not dispute them. You should discuss them and not dispute them. When you're discussing your disagreements, then you're respecting one another and you're loving one another. You can handle everything without yelling. Trust me, you actually get further if you don't yell. Yelling just pits you further and further against one another. Since I was about 17 years old, I had this verse memorized. And it's a good one for life in general. It's a great one for marriage. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1. Grievous words stir up anger, but a soft answer turneth away wrath. That's King James Version, right? A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. You can say things in a polite and kind way, and you can really get somewhere with your spouse. Or you can yell at each other and verbally beat on each other and see if that works for you. It's not going to work for you. Just save yourself the time. Always speak softly and kindly to your spouses, no matter what. Just don't allow yourself to do anything but that. Just refuse to do anything but that, because that's your spouse. That's she married you. He married you. That's your other half. There's a good chance it's your better half. So respect them, honor them, help them, love them. Make it so that what they think and feel becomes even more important to you than what you think and feel. If you get there, you're in a good place. Verse 23. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. Ooh, okay, now what? What do you do with that, pastor? Did God punish Michal with barrenness because she tried to tell David, you needed more clothing on? And you really, like, it just seemed to me like you were self-seeking and self-honoring out there. Is that what happened? Did God punish her for trying to correct David? I think you know I'm going to say no, right? But if you believe that David is just completely in the right here and that Michal is completely in the wrong, then this would be your proof text. This would be your verse to support that, you know, God weighed in on this and God judged her and punished her. He made her barren for the rest of her life. Listen, I don't think this is a revelation about what God did to Michal. I think this is a revelation to us about what David did to Michal, or rather, what he didn't do. I think what this is teaching us is that from this time forward, there's a wedge in the marriage. David is no longer sleeping with Michal. And as a result, she no longer has a child, and there is forever then this strain on their relationship, and they never snap out of it. McCall didn't handle this the way she should have. David certainly did not handle it the way that he should have. And that wedge just drove them further and further and further apart. Unresolved issues. It's one of the strengths of a marriage is that you do not let anything go unresolved. You resolve it. If you feel like you're losing your closeness, resolve it. If you think there's a rift between you two, resolve it. If there's any negative feelings in your heart for your spouse, get it fixed. Talk it out. Resolve it. Because if you don't, you just keep going in different directions, further and further apart. And before long, you look like these two that started with true love and now completely torn apart. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, and wives, see to it that you respect your husbands. Let's stand and close in a word of prayer.